Hello, and welcome back to the next episode of In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real-life courtroom drama. As always, I'm your host, Paul Townsend, and in this show, I have a rare treat for you. Since I've started doing the show during the COVID pandemic, listeners have raised the idea of me bringing on a guest or co-host to discuss the legal topics and issues that I go through. So, I'm a man of the people, and I give the people what they want. Today, I'm going to be joined by my colleague, an attorney for whom I have the utmost respect and admiration, Robert Gottlieb of the famed Robert C. Gottlieb & Associates, which you hear me say every episode. Today, we're going to discuss a case which I think is very important to the history of this country. And what makes it so important is just how wrong it was. It highlights not only how important civil liberties and freedoms are, but how easily and quickly government can strip them, and how it is the responsibility of all of us as citizens to speak out when we see it happening. On December 7th, 1941, radio transmissions across the country were interrupted with breaking news that the military base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, had been bombed by Japanese planes. The news rocked the country, which was already obsessively watching the chaos taking place on the European continent as the Axis countries of Germany, Italy, and Japan inched ever closer towards world domination. After the bombing, President Franklin Roosevelt declared every person of Japanese ancestry over the age of 14 to be an enemy alien. Their rights were suspended, their homes could be searched without a warrant. The hysteria escalated, and before long, California's Attorney General Earl Warren, a man who would later become a champion of civil rights as Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, began advocating for the expulsion of the Japanese from his state. Ruled by irrational fears instead of adhering to the governing principles of what the United States was founded on, the United States government ultimately mandated that anyone of Japanese descent living on the West Coast could be relocated to internment camps. Most felt they had no choice and voluntarily relocated to these centers. A few, however, did not. One, in particular, was not trying to make a political statement or spark an uprising. He just didn't want to leave his girlfriend. But his actions led him to become the face of the opposition to internment in an ugly showdown at the Supreme Court, which shows all of us just how quickly we will strip the rights of citizens if we're afraid. This is Fred Korematsu versus the United States. Well, listeners, from the very beginning of this podcast, right from when I started, the overarching comment that I have been getting is, when are you going to actually start bringing people onto the show to discuss these topics with you? And as much as I try not to take offense to people's reaction to me doing this by myself, I have decided to bring on a colleague, a friend, and somebody who is not only an excellent advocate and lawyer, but somebody who is a very, very deep thinker and whose opinion on virtually every topic I very much respect. And so I'm very fortunate to have the Robert Gottlieb of Robert C. Gottlieb & Associates on the show. Because this is a slightly new format, the way that we're going to proceed is I'll give a brief recitation of this week's case, Korematsu, and then Bob and I will discuss both the arguments that were made, the implications of those arguments, the merits of them, the rulings from the trial court level through the circuit up to the Supreme Court, and even beyond the 1940s when this case took place, into what the lasting implications of this case are and how history has treated it. So with that, we'll start with a very brief recitation of facts regarding Korematsu. And to really understand what happened in this case and the tragedy that resulted, you need to understand a bit about what was going on in the world at the time. On December 7th, 1941, the United States military base at Pearl Harbor was bombed. President Franklin Roosevelt quickly declared all Japanese immigrants over the age of 14 to be enemy aliens. Their homes could be searched, and items that were determined to be able to be useful to help the Japanese army could be confiscated without warrants. Prominent voices in the media began advocating for the internment of people of Japanese ancestry. California Attorney General Earl Warren who would later become the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, argued publicly for the expulsion of the Japanese from California. There were only two prominent voices against internment. There were the country's Attorney General, Francis Biddle, and J. Edgar Hoover, who was hardly a staunch advocate for civil liberties. But the military was very much for it. General John DeWitt, head of the Western Command, authored what was charitably called at the time a report, but was really more of an op-ed piece, which claimed, quote, "The very fact that no sabotage has taken place to date is a disturbing and confirming indication that such action will be taken," end quote. DeWitt's claim was that the fact that not a single Japanese immigrant or American of Japanese descent had taken any steps towards harming America was proof positive that such an action would happen. Barely more than 2 months after Pearl Harbor, on February 19, 1942, President Roosevelt signed a removal order, the first step towards internment. This was followed by a series of proclamations which called for voluntary evacuation of certain areas, curfews, and the establishment of assembly centers, where Japanese people were essentially confined until a spot for them opened up in a camp and they could be relocated there. With that background in mind, we turn to Fred Korematsu. Fred was a first-generation American. His father emigrated from Japan in 1904, and his mother came 9 years later. Fred was their third son, born in 1919. Fred was actually not his real name. His elementary school teacher couldn't pronounce his true name and asked him if he'd like to be called Fred instead. And the name stuck, and he was called Fred ever since. He had mostly white friends growing up. He was a Boy Scout, attended church every Sunday, played tennis, and was on the swim team. He had a typical American childhood. He was also very patriotic. In 1940, when the peacetime draft was initiated, Fred volunteered but was rejected because of a gastric ulcer. Still, he tried to support the war effort. He got jobs working at a shipyard and an iron factory, but he was expelled from both of these companies because of his race. When the exclusion order was signed, Fred was 21 years old and was very much in love with his girlfriend at the time, Ida Boitano. He wanted to run away with Ida to a place outside of the exclusion zone, but she didn't want to leave California. To be with Ida, Fred remained in a prohibited zone, where he was arrested and charged with violating the exclusion order 3 weeks after he was supposed to have vacated. Fred's actions were not meant to be some grand gesture or protest against the unfairness of the order. He wasn't seeking to make a public statement about the racism of the policy or the lack of justification for the claim that Japanese Americans constituted a threat to America. He did feel strongly that it was wrong, but mostly he just didn't want to leave his girlfriend. So with that brief background in mind, we come to Fred's first trial for violating the exclusion order. And so, Bob, I'm going to ask you to give me your thoughts on the order itself and the government's and the defense's arguments regarding the initial trial of Fred Korematsu.
It's actually very interesting because oftentimes lawyers have to make a decision whether or not you try to win the case by focusing on a very narrow issue, a technical issue. And courts love to decide cases based on very narrow issues rather than to take grand proclamations because they really don't know where that's going to lead. So that became an immediate decision that had to be made. And Korematsu wound up having an attorney who was willing to take on this issue for what it was. In the ACLU's opinion, his lawyer's opinion, this struck at the heart of what this country stands for. It was unconstitutional. That was the approach that they wanted to take and to have the courts overturn it. Ultimately, the trial really just boiled down to whether or not there was an order, a military order, and whether or not he violated the order. And the truth is, the facts were not in dispute. He admitted violating it. He admitted knowing about the order. He knew that he was not supposed to be on the streets. and knowing that he was not supposed to be there, he was supposed to be relocated, he violated that order, and he was convicted. And being convicted, that then sets up all the appeals to the federal courts, to the Court of Appeals, and ultimately to the Supreme Court.
And I think that's such an interesting point that you raise regarding the trial strategy of either focusing on one narrow aspect of the case versus attacking, you know, the general proposition that the government has put forward. And in this case, you know, the general proposition that the government had put forward was that because of Pearl Harbor, because of the war, that all Japanese people, all 112,000 people of Japanese descent that were in this country were an imminent threat. And Korematsu was represented by a man named Ernest Besig, as you said, from the ACLU. And Besig had made it clear from the moment he met Korematsu that what he wanted to do was use Korematsu's prosecution as an avenue straight to attack what he and what the ACLU felt was a horribly unconstitutional infringement of individual rights. So I think that's an excellent point to note, that in this case, whereas some attorneys might have just tried to argue, you know, a finer point of where Korematsu was, or, you know, whether or not he was aware of the order, or whether it was an honest mistake, the ACLU wanted it to be clear that they felt that the order itself was on trial and not Korematsu.
And Paul, listen, oftentimes making a decision on a different strategy on a very narrow point is actually smart if you want to win. But I think everybody should be very clear and understand that there was really no other way, from the way I look at it, to fight this than on the very broad constitutional grounds, because there could not be any defense that had any snowball's chance in hell of prevailing, because he was supposed to be out. He was supposed to have vacated and to gone into, whether you call it a relocation camp or a concentration camp, which then finds its way throughout the court proceedings that followed. There was really no factual issue. And we should really be thankful that broad issue, the attack, the frontal attack on the unconstitutionality of the statute, was raised, was brought up, and then ultimately becomes an example of what this country was willing to do. And as we're going to discuss, what the country has continued to be willing to do under certain circumstances, military and otherwise.
Let's talk about the appeal to the Ninth Circuit. So Korematsu, as you know, loses in the trial court. And I think you're right. There was no other avenue he could have taken. It's pretty clear that within minutes of being stopped, you know, he broke down. He admitted he was of Japanese descent. He admitted that he had changed a name on his draft card and that he had, you know, had surgery to augment his features. So there was consciousness of guilt riddled in the case. And so, yeah, I agree. The ACLU's main strategy was the right one, to go right to the heart of exclusion. The Civil Liberties Union lived up to their name in defending the civil liberties of everybody of Japanese descent who had been taken to an assembly center at the time. And the trial court's ruling of basically saying, yes, there was an order. Yes, he violated it. Yes, that is what it is. It gave the ACLU a platform to raise this at the circuit level. And so the case goes up to the Ninth Circuit. But the Ninth Circuit is a little hesitant. You know, can you kind of talk about that for a minute?
The Ninth Circuit realized the significance of the decision and the significance of whatever decision ultimately was going to be reached on appeal. So, as we often see with courts and judges, they punted, or they tried to punt. They petitioned, they went to the Supreme Court and said, you decide, this is a broad constitutional issue. This deserves consideration by the United States Supreme Court, our highest court. And the Supreme Court said, no deal. You guys do your job. You take a look at it. And then, in accordance with the procedures that have long been established, based on your decision, we will then be in a position to either consider, accept an appeal, or deny it further down the line. So the Ninth Circuit affirms and winds up ultimately going to the Supreme Court, which was a foregone conclusion that it was ultimately going to be decided by the Supreme Court.
I agree. There is no way that this wasn't going to make its way to the Supreme Court. But I do think the nuances of the arguments were a little bit different in the Ninth Circuit than they were at the trial court. So essentially, at the Ninth Circuit, the ACLU argues to the panel of judges that never in the history of this country had the rights of citizens, because this applied both to non-citizens and citizens. So never in the history of this country had the rights of citizens been infringed solely because of their ancestry. And I thought that that was a particularly powerful argument to be making, you know, in the 1940s. And the government's response to that, the way that they justified the order in the Ninth Circuit was to say, well, we don't know how to tell who the loyal Japanese are from the disloyal. And the court never stopped to ask, how do you know any of them are disloyal? There was no explanation given by the government or no proof offered to say, well, we know that there are some disloyal Japanese because X, Y, and Z. That is not a part of the appeal. When you look back in history, and they didn't have the benefit of this at the time, but there is not a single instance of either carried out or even attempted sabotage of any military or civilian installation by a single person of Japanese descent during the entirety of World War II.
What defies any acceptance of embracing this country's ideals and laws is the notion that because they were incapable of producing one iota of evidence to show that Korematsu posed a specific danger other than his Japanese ancestry, that absence of evidence could then ultimately, as we learn in the Supreme Court, wind up being used against him on the basis that the absence of evidence only heightens the fear, only heightens the danger to warrant being placed in a concentration camp. It's not only a unique view of history, it should be viewed, and it is viewed by people today and scholars today. It's a dangerous view and analysis that was undertaken then. And the question, which I know we'll discuss, is whether or not we can see that sort of very narrow-mindedness view and consideration, could it ever find its way in today's modern era? And the answer is, of course, yes.
And another thing that struck me, and I try and be mindful of the overall timber of the country at the time. It, you know, it is not that long since World War I, and now we're in World War II, and there's anxiety, and there's paranoia, and there's fear. And I understand that from an academic standpoint, that people were afraid. But I think it's the responsibility of the judiciary to look at the things that our institutions try and do you know, whether it's the military, whether it's the FBI, whether it's local police departments. And it's the responsibility of our sober judges to examine the policies, the laws, the rules that get made and say, taking a step back, looking at this not as general society, because our judiciary is not the general society. They are called to be better than that. They are called to be the ones who put the fear aside and say, is this legal? Is it warranted? Are we allowing ourselves to do this under the Constitution? And I think that this case on every level represents a failure of every judge who this case got in front of to take the reasonable step to say, no, this violates virtually every civil rights amendment that had come by the 1940s. And so I think the lesson from Korematsu is that if certain institutions who have the specific role in our society of playing that gatekeeper, that watchdog, if they don't act, then we give and we cede the rights that we have to institutions like law enforcement or the military. And we have seen time and time again that they view safety and security as the only thing that matters. Individual rights go by the wayside because we have to keep people safe. And individual rights, you know, anybody who's listened to the show and has listened to me talk about other cases, I am obviously a very staunch supporter of individual rights. And I obviously put a value on safety and security, but not at the expense of the constitutional rights of the citizens of this country. And I think that we have to look at Korematsu as a failure of the judges to uphold their duty to secure the individual rights, which is the foundational element of justice in this country.
Listen, but what's interesting about that. People should not misunderstand that this was not only was in fact on the heels of World War I and then a horrific bombing at Pearl Harbor. But the issue of sacrificing liberty for a little bit of security has its roots going way back, as you know, to Benjamin Franklin. It was repeated and we were warned by it, about it by Robert Kennedy. At its genesis is Benjamin Franklin going way back to the beginning, who in effect said that those willing or nation willing to sacrifice liberty for a little bit of security deserve neither. So this is not something that just arose on the heels of civil rights legislation, fears that people had about blacks or other minorities. This goes back to the very foundation fears that people have always reacted to, going back to the founding of this country.
I agree. I think that's something that there's always in almost any society. I think there is a push and pull between individual rights on one hand and safety and security of society on the other. And, you know, there's always a line that is drawn. And what we try and do as a civilized society is find that balance of where individual rights are maintained and yet people stay safe. For instance, you know, I went to public school, and in my school, you know, you had to be vaccinated to go. You know, we have seatbelt laws, you know, that people can argue infringe on, you know, certain individual rights to make decisions about the way you want to live your life. And those are things that by and large we accept and we live our lives according to. You know, we understand that if I drive without wearing my seatbelt and I get pulled over, I'm going to get a ticket, and I'm not going to raise a constitutional issue about individual rights if I get ticketed for driving without a seatbelt. But the issue is when some seismic event happens and all of a sudden that balance gets upset, we need to be able to rely on the institutions who are in charge of maintaining the balance to make everyone take a step back and say, whoa, whoa, whoa. Just because this happened doesn't mean that individual rights go out the window and we can take 112,000 people, none of whom have showcased any desire to harm America, and put them in whatever you call them, assembly centers, internment camps, concentration camps, for lack of a better term. That's essentially what they were. And that, I think, is one of the takeaways of Korematsu that should be a lasting legacy, is that the individual rights versus safety and security balance needs to be maintained regardless of what's going on in the world.
And we have seen in our history that the power of the military to not only to protect us, because that's a given, and they should be recognized for all the positive that they have done, but the military also has the power to influence a bad policy. And if the military comes out and says, this is military order number 4 or 30, 34, 39, people are more apt to listen to the military and to be concerned that if they don't do what the military says should be done to protect us, the reason why the courts, as you say, must be the ultimate arbiter is that if you don't have the judicial branch looking at what the military is doing and ordering, that is so contrary to this country's separation of authority and powers. And people are more apt to listen to the military, even if it means giving up rights, especially if it means and results in someone else's rights being abridged. Not mine, not yours, but a Japanese ancestry, even without any proof that that person has done anything that warrants fear to be had in anyone's heart or mind. It was enough for the military to say, this is a military order. The military wants these relocation centers. We want these people off the West Coast. We don't want them in California, Washington, and we want them to be sent to Utah. The people are going to have a tendency to follow that unless judges step in and say, you've gone a bridge too far.
I think that's an excellent point. And I think the idea that it's so much easier for us to watch the rights of others get infringed and to say to ourselves, yeah, that's probably not right. That's probably a violation of rights, but you know, it doesn't really affect me. I think there's a lot of that that goes on, that went on then and goes on now. And I think that's a very salient point that goes to kind of how we have evolved as a country since the time of Korematsu. But I'd like to move now to the Supreme Court case, because this is really where the country now is taking notice. The ACLU, Ernest Bessig, has now teamed up with an attorney named Wayne Collins to argue the case in front of the Supreme Court. The ACLU tries to expand the argument from just the exclusion order that Korematsu had been convicted of violating to encompass the entire program. They wanted internment, assembly centers, exclusions. They wanted all of it to be determined unconstitutional. So when Korematsu came in front of the Supreme Court, they went after everything. So why don't we take a minute and discuss the arguments put forth by the ACLU and the response that Solicitor General Charles Fahey, who argued for the government and really for the military's position, whether or not they were seemingly meritorious, well thought out, well argued. Bessig and Collins basically target the report made by General DeWitt. They claim that it lacks fact or data, and it's just a speculative, prejudice-laced diatribe of racism against people of Japanese ancestry, and was a poor basis to enact all of these policies that violated the Fourth Amendment, due process, equal protection, and the Eighth Amendment. And the government's position, argued by Mr. Fahey, was that whether or not the claims in the report were true is an irrelevant consideration. The only relevant thing, according to Fahey, was that there was a good faith basis to believe that Japanese Americans and others of Japanese ancestry posed a national security threat, and that justified internment. So, Bob, I want to ask you, do you think that either of these arguments had merit? And if so, or if not, why?
I think both sides articulated the issue. I think both sides presented to the Supreme Court what the issue was and what had to be resolved. And it becomes clear that the Supreme Court knew that there was merit that was being raised by Korematsu, because consider what the Supreme Court ultimately says in its decision. First, they concede that there is no question raised about the loyalty to the United States by that young man. So that's not an issue. The Supreme Court, sensitive to the argument that his lawyers made, set up how they're going to determine this case. What's the test? And they start off at the beginning of their opinion saying things like all legal restrictions which curtail the civil rights of a single racial group are immediately suspect. That's not to say that all such restrictions, the court continued, are unconstitutional. It's to say that courts must subject them to the most rigid scrutiny. So, right away, anyone reading that hot off the press is saying, my God, the Supreme Court is going to rule in favor of Korematsu, because they are not simply saying whatever the military says goes. They're saying it's got to be whatever the order is subject to rigid scrutiny. So they then go on to say, pressing public necessity may sometimes justify the existence of such restrictions. Racial antagonism never can. So holy geez, you're reading this, the initial few pages of the report, and you're saying, they are saying, there are certain circumstances which by necessity, militarily, may require an order such as this, but it cannot be based on racial antagonism. And they then begin to pivot after throwing the bone to Korematsu, throwing the bone to the United States Constitution in recognition of what this country is supposed to be all about. They then set up the pivot by then saying, successful prosecution of the war requires every possible protection to protect against espionage and against sabotage to national defense material, national defense premises, and national defense utilities. So the court, in on the one hand, saying we can't just run amok and violate our constitutional rights. It's got to be strict, rigid scrutiny. But they then are setting up the ultimate conclusion that the military necessity, the fear that we have, even though there's no proof that this individual, this citizen, poses a specific threat, the fear that the country is facing of sabotage among a group of Japanese ancestry was enough to ultimately uphold the order, which was placing two-thirds of what, 120,000?
112,000.
112,000 people. Two-thirds of them were like you and me. They were American citizens without one scintilla of evidence that any of them were engaged in any sabotage or espionage. And that ultimately rued the day, and that's why ultimately he winds up losing.
I as I read through the decision, it really struck me, as you pointed out, how at the very beginning, you know, if I had been the lawyer in that case, and if I had just been reading, I would have gotten my heart would have started pounding, blood would have been racing. I would have thought, man, they are going to rule for me. They are going to rule that this whole program was completely unconstitutional from the beginning, and they're going to shut it down. And then after you get about a third of the way into the opinion, you hit that wall where they say, but, and then they go on to kind of perform these legal gymnastics to allow for certain programs to go on for the purpose of national security. And at no point does the court wrestle with the fact that there is no evidence that any person of Japanese ancestry, poses a threat. They do talk about Korematsu. They talk about the fact that he doesn't appear to be an enemy combatant. But the same could be said of every single person who went through internment. As we said before, there were no arrests for attempted or completed sabotage. There was no evidence ever put forward that any particular individual was attempting to do anything to aid the Japanese war effort. So while the Supreme Court is all happy about the fact that Fred Korematsu was not somebody who they were concerned about harming America, they don't extend that feeling towards all the other people in the suspect class that they have just created. And for me, that's where this opinion takes a very wrong turn, because they created – this was the first case where the Supreme Court created a new scrutiny level, strict scrutiny, where any rule that affects a suspect class like race or gender has to have a compelling government interest and be the least restrictive way to accomplish the end. And in this case, they create strict scrutiny, but then they don't apply it.
And you see, you're absolutely right, because they create the appearance, the facade of strict scrutiny, which would give hope to anyone who really wants to uphold the Constitution. But they actually say the following in the opinion after the pivot that we're talking about. The court says, we cannot reject as unfounded the judgment of the military authorities and of Congress that there were disloyal members of Japanese population. So the court is saying, because they have no proof that the military is wrong, that now supports and allows them to affirm the congressional order, tossing them out of their homes. They add a gratuitous comment that they're not unmindful of hardships imposed by the order upon a large group of American citizens. But they then, in such a brazen, insensitive manner, go on to say, but hardships are a part of war, and war is an aggregation of hardships. So basically the court is saying, tough luck, one group of American citizens. We all suffer because of war. You're going to suffer a little bit more, not because we have proof that you intend or have done anything wrong, but because we don't know enough about you. And in order to give us some feeling of safety, we're just going to put you in a camp somewhere. And of course, they toward the end of their opinion, because they're feeling the heat. They know there are going to be people who are going to say, what the heck's going on with the Supreme Court? They also take umbrage and offense that people would call these relocation camps concentration camps, because they didn't like being called out for what it was really going on here.
And I think you really hit it on the head when you quoted the line, you know, we cannot reject as unfounded the military's determination. And the fact, as we keep harping on it, is it was unfounded. And there was literally no evidence that the military ever put forward that said, we have reason to believe, because of this, that these people represent a clear and present danger to the west coast of America. All they were able to say was, we're at war with Japan. These people are from Japan at some point, so therefore they're dangerous. And yet we were also at war with Italy and with Germany. And there was never any call to put Italian Americans or German Americans in concentration camps. There was no widespread fear that they would take up arms and help the motherland. It was only Japanese people.
And that's why the way the Supreme Court then articulated what this is all about just as disingenuous. Supreme Court, in its decision, said, our task would be simple, our duty clear. Were this a case involving the imprisonment of a loyal citizen in concentration camps because of racial prejudice? Well, this was a case of racial prejudice. But they had to formulate their decision on something else other than racial animus, racial prejudice. So they fell back on what we have seen from the beginning of this nation, the military, and that tension that you cited from the beginning between security and liberty. The military represents the security, and Karamatsu had to give up his liberty in order to allay the fears. And it was based solely, as you've pointed out, because Germans were not rounded up and Italians were not rounded up. They were all involved abroad in warfare. It was only the Japanese who looked different who wound up being sent to these camps.
Last thing we'll say about the Supreme Court decision is that it was a 6-3 decision. And there were, you know, some justices who sided with the majority, who would later in life claim that the Korematsu decision was their biggest, you know, regret of their career. I am imagining that most of them, with the benefit of hindsight, would look back on that decision and agree that they had got it wrong. The three dissenters, even though they each agreed with each other, all wrote their own independent dissent to voice how strenuously they felt that this was an unconstitutional abuse of authority targeted at a particular class of people.
And in fact, one of them, it was Justice Murphy, actually provided a reasonable test, a way to go about evaluating an order such as this. His test is whether the government, in a plea of military necessity, can validly deprive an individual of any of his constitutional rights, is whether the deprivation is reasonable, related to a public danger that is so, quote, immediate, imminent, and impending, as not to admit or delay and to permit the intervention of ordinary constitutional processes to alleviate the danger. So it was in the dissent, they are articulating that there's a way to balance security, needs and interests, and liberty. And it could never be based on an unfounded, broad, generalized prejudice and fear in the absence of any specific danger that can be attributed to the individual or individuals who you are then depriving of their basic rights to equal protection, to be treated fairly under due process of law with hearings. You can't just do it because you're afraid.
I think that Murphy really understood the issue and articulated his position on it incredibly well. And it's unfortunate that the other justices did not see it that way. We're going to wrap up in a couple minutes, but I want to take this last segment, the opportunity to kind of looking back over the last 80 years or so, 75 years, between when Korematsu was decided and today, And we should just note that the Korematsu case has been overturned, and he received a Presidential Medal of Freedom for essentially what was done to him and his willingness to be the individual that fought internment. But my question for you now is, you know, since that time, have we learned to balance liberty and safety, or are we still in a position where at any given point some emergency could result in internment?
We have not, in my opinion, really learned and embraced the lessons of Korematsu. You can go back to the Vietnam War with the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which led to the United States becoming involved, where Congress, in effect, gave up all of its power to the president to decide whether or not to prosecute the war in Vietnam because of political reasons. There, it was not even the fear other than the so-called domino theory, where the Americans were told that if we don't beat them in Vietnam, they're going to be attacking New York. And we basically gave up our critical and essential constitutionally protected powers of Congress to decide whether or not to declare war. You can go to the War Powers Act. You go back to the war Iraq under Bush, the Patriot Act following September 11, where this country, when it has faced great fear and danger, has been willing to give up liberties in exchange for at least a feeling, even if it wasn't real, a feeling of safety. And then we saw it at the beginning of former President Trump's administration with the Muslim ban. No matter how they would argue that it was not discriminatory and it wasn't focused simply on one group of people, the facts showed otherwise. The facts showed otherwise that because then it became a political issue, there were terrorist bombings throughout the world, and we had a president and then Congress simply rubber-stamped decisions and orders denying a group of individuals, Muslims, their religion, from admission to the United States. So have we learned the lesson? I think many people are aware of the problem. I think in today's world, people are willing to articulate the reasons why we should say, whoa, just because the government says so doesn't mean it necessarily goes. But in very recent history, civil liberties in our Constitution have taken a backseat to the efforts to provide people some sense of safety and security and expressions of their own prejudices. And they're willing to give up civil liberties in that exchange.
Well, Bob, that's all the time that I have in this podcast. Thank you so much for coming on. This was an amazing experience for me. I was very nervous about how my first guest would go, but I'm really, really happy. I think you brought a really great perspective on these, and you know, have a deep understanding of the issues of Korematsu, as well as the legacy of Korematsu, and where we were and where we are, and kind of how this balancing act of civil liberties and security kind of play with each other, and how delicate that balance is, and how, you know, it's fleeting, and what can happen if that balance is overturned. The real tragedy that can result, I mean, in Korematsu, we saw 112,000 people who all peacefully and for the most part voluntarily put themselves into camps just to prove that they were not a danger. And the response that we got from the Supreme Court is, you are a danger. So,
well, Paul, can I just say it has been an honor and a privilege to be on with you. This sort of podcast is really important, and I wish you the very best, and I thank you for allowing me to share a few minutes with you.
Oh, thanks very much, Bob. Hopefully we'll do it again sometime soon.
My pleasure.
So that's the show for this week. I really hope you enjoyed Bob Gottlieb and my discussion of Korematsu. A very special thank you to Bob for coming on the show and lending your expertise and your insights. And a thank you again, as always, to my audio engineer, Dan Townsend, for cleaning up the audio and making it sound sparkly and shiny. If you like the show, please feel free to subscribe and leave a comment on whatever platform you watch it on, as that will help other people find it, and maybe they'll learn a little something about these historical cases as well. If you have any feedback for me, you can reach me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at insummationpod, or you can look me up on my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. I realize that this show was a little bit longer, but I think it was absolutely worth it, and I would have been really upset if we had had to cut any of the discussion down, because I really think that it provided a lot of key insights about the intersection of civil liberties and security that really go to the heart of what Korematsu is all about. So thanks, everyone, for listening and stopping by, and I hope that you will come back for more.